Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Good afternoon, good morning, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world. The joys of being able to hold these meetings virtually is that so many of you can listen in. So thank you very much for joining us for this extremely interesting and important discussion on how we transition to net zero, especially looking at the financial services sector. So this discussion broadly looks at how Spain and the UK can work closely to deliver the COP26 private finance hub strategy, and also wider discussions on preparation for COP26 and what those hope to see afterwards. I'm very pleased to welcome everybody to this session. If you have questions, please do type them in the function that you see in the Slido function next to the screen. We are pleased to have the keynote addresses from Gonzalo Muniz, the high-level climate action champion, then followed by Emma Howard-Boyd, interim chair at Green Finance Institute. And we have William Russell, Lord Mayor of the City of London. Following this, we have the panel discussion with Danai Karakapulu, who is the Senior Policy Fellow at Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and Environment at the London School of Economics. She is also chairing the OMFIF SP Sustainable Policy Institute. And I want to say a special thanks to the British Embassy in Madrid, who have been working tirelessly with OMFIF throughout this process, and also the Spanish Chamber of Commerce in the United Kingdom. So thank you to both. We have the representation of also the president of the Spanish Chamber of Commerce in the UK later in the proceedings, and Hugh Elliott, the British ambassador to Spain and Andorra, will be closing proceedings. So you will see me later, also moderating the second session. So thank you all. And without further ado, I am pleased to hand over to Gonzalo Muniz to make the opening statements. Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us today, and to the British Embassy in Madrid for this discussion. We are less than 50 days out from COP26. In the year since the summit was meant to be held in 2020, the sense of urgency behind the need for rapid action on climate change has only grown. Only a few weeks ago, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, released their new assessment on climate science in what the UN Secretary General called a code red for humanity. There are three key messages and findings in the report. First one, human-induced climate change is indisputable. Second, climate change is affecting every region on our planet. Third, strong, rapid reductions in greenhouse gas emissions are needed to curb global warming. The warning signs are already apparent, little storms, heat waves, and floods that we've seen in recent weeks and months. Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, has warned, "This report is a code red for humanity. The alarm bells are deafening, and the evidence is irrefutable. Greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel burning and deforestation are choking our planet and putting billions of people at immediate risk." He called for an end to new coal plants and to new fossil fuel exploration and development, and for governments, investors, and businesses to pour all their efforts into a low-carbon future. This report, he said, must sound a death knell for coal and fossil fuels before they destroy our planet. So what we need to achieve at COP26? First thing is to secure global net zero by mid-century at the very latest and keep the 1.5 degrees Celsius within reach. Countries are being asked to come forward with ambitious 2030 emissions reduction targets. Second, we need, of course, to adapt to protect communities and natural habitats. Third, we need to mobilize finance. The developed countries must deliver on their promise to raise at least $100 billion in climate finance per year. And fourth, of course, finalize the Paris rulebook, the rules for implementing the Paris Agreement. So all eyes are now at COP26, and the world wants Glasgow and needs Glasgow to be a success. The urgency is absolutely clear, the political and public support stronger, the non-state actors' momentum greater than ever. The UK COP presidency has been really clear that non-state actors action, including finance, won't be a sideshow, but central to the agenda at Glasgow. The way the summit is organized over the fortnight deliberately places a focus beyond the negotiations on the real economic transformation needed to keep 1.5 alive and achieve net zero. Each day will place a spotlight on evidencing the transformation underway and the breakthrough actions we need. As you all know, after the World Leaders Summit on the first 2 days, the focus turns immediately to finance, reflecting its pivotal role in the transition and shaping the real economy. The central role of finance in the summit is a reflection of how the sector has moved to the center of the agenda on climate, which is a testament to Mark's leadership and the work of the private finance hub focusing minds around the risk returns reporting framework. So how can you all get involved in COP26? Every company, bank, insurer, and investor will need to adjust their business model, develop credible plan for the transition to a low carbon and climate resilient future, and then implement those plans. We need the whole of the financial system on board. In that sense, the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, GFANZ, that was launched in April 21 by myself and my dear friend Nigel Topping, the Climate Action Champions, with, of course, Mark Carney, UN Special Envoy for Climate Action and Finance, and the UK Prime Minister's Finance Advisor for COP26, and the COP26 Private Finance Hub, in partnership with the UNFCCC Climate Action Champions and the COP26 Presidency. Bringing together existing and new net zero finance initiatives in one sector-wide coalition, GFANZ provides a forum for strategic coordination among the leadership of finance institutions to accelerate the transition to a net zero economy. GFANZ is a global coalition of leading financial institutions committed to accelerating the decarbonization of the economy. Members currently include more than 250 financial firms responsible for assets in excess to $88 trillion. The coalition is focused on broadening, deepening, and raising net zero ambitions across the financial system all around the world, allowing firms to demonstrate their collective commitments to supporting companies and countries to achieve the goals of the Paris Agreement. I strongly encourage financial firms to demonstrate their commitments to achieving global net zero goals by joining the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero. To do this, you need to join a Race to Zero finance initiative and commit to net zero actions aligned with science. We have Race to Zero finance initiatives for asset owners, for asset managers, for insurance underwriters and banks. The Race to Zero has robust criteria that all initiatives must meet, grouped under the what we call the four P's: pledge, plan, proceed, and publish. So in that sense, what success looks like and where innovation is needed towards COP26 and towards a net zero resilient world. It is increasingly clear where stakeholders are looking to judge success. On one side, near-term commitments with a focus on what's needed by 2030 for businesses and non-state actors. This means halving emissions in the next 9 years. It's not only about what you will be achieving by mid-century, it's what would you be achieving in this critical decade. Also, succeeding in achieving more of the breakthrough actions needed in every sector on the path to net zero, with evidence of near-term action from critical numbers of real economy actors. Also, mobilizing the capital needed, not just the $100 billion that are promised by governments, but the trillions that are needed to transform emerging as well as advanced economies. Also, fossil fuel phase out, with a focus on whether the world is serious about consigning coal to history. And stakeholders are looking for the evidence that finance is supporting this. Then the rules and the architecture in place to deliver the actions needed from states and non-state actors. And finally, not just focusing on mitigation and reducing emissions, but ensuring there is a proper plan in place to build climate resilience for 4 billion of the most vulnerable people in the world. In the UK, in Spain, and in Latin America, we have strong cultures of innovation and an increasing interest in green finance. The net zero transition offers a significant opportunity to build back better with finance players critical to the innovation that is needed. In Latin America, we are seeing countries like my country, Chile, emitting green bonds with great success. Asset managers like Lindsor Capital implementing ESG and the 1.5 trajectory in all their portfolio. And banks like Bancolombia developing products for the clients related to best practices like Certified B Corporation or Race to Zero. Let me close by saying that the moment is now. Science has spoken loud. The natural evidence is hitting harder. The citizens of the world are concerned. The technology is ready and the money is starting to flow in the right direction. The risk of inaction is unacceptable. The size of the opportunity is immense. And we have a moral duty to act. Join Race to Zero today.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to now welcome Emma Howard-Boyd to make her remarks.
Hello, everyone, and always great to share a platform with Gonzalo. In planning for future events, it's useful to look at what's happened in the past. With COP26 this year, it might be helpful to think about COP21 in Paris. The Paris Agreement remains the most impressive international agreement to deal with the climate emergency to date. Agreement and action take hard work and organisation, even among like-minded nations. When I was at COP21 in December 2015, when the Paris Agreement was being signed, I was attending as part of a financial delegation to talk about the opportunities brought by the transition to a low-carbon economy. At that point, I was also on the board of the Environment Agency, and midway through the 2 weeks of COP, I remember being briefed by colleagues about some of the worst flooding England has ever seen. On December the 5th, 2015, a record 341.4 millimetres of rain fell in 24 hours at Honister Pass in the Lake District. The flooding that followed did not let up until February 2016. The connection between the optimism of the COP conferences and what we all know climate change will bring, even for developed nations, is vital to successfully dealing with climate change. Spain and the UK share many opportunities and challenges in the low carbon transition. In the UK, the Climate Change Committee monitors the actions taken by the UK government to tackle and adapt to climate change. In its latest report this year, it noted the government's recent climate commitments and net zero target, for which it deserves credit. But it is less flattering when it looks at the short-term action that sets us on the path towards delivery. Spain has ambitious recovery and resilience plans for renewables, particularly solar. Spain has earmarked €7 billion for building renovation in its plan and will spend that by 2023. But €45 billion is required in the next decade to decarbonise. Both countries still have much to do and difficult choices lie ahead. In both countries and elsewhere around the world, we know that public finance can help bring in private capital. By acting as a credit enhancer, taking first losses, or insuring a default fund, public funding can attract the required multiples of private capital. And this needs to happen in the EU building renovation market, which has the largest climate investment gap of any sector, €275 billion per year to 2030. The €750 billion of next generation EU funding has to be put to use in public-private partnerships that can use both policy and financial innovation to sustain the renovation wave past 2030 and beyond. There is no point in building an energy efficient house that could be washed away in a flood. Buildings need to be ready for climate shocks too. The UK's Green Finance Institute, which I also chair, set up the Coalition for the Energy Efficiency of Buildings in 2019 to develop the market for financing a net zero carbon and climate resilient built environment in the UK. Today, the CEIB has over 300 members and accounts for 70% of the UK mortgage market. It is recognised as the leading authority for financing energy efficient buildings in the UK by the market and government, and we are expanding this model into Europe. The Coalition for Climate Resilient Investment is also making a global impact by pricing climate risks, particularly for infrastructure, and including them in upfront financial decision making. The CCR's aim is to incentivise a shift towards greater resilience. Members of the coalition now have over $16 trillion in assets. The world increasingly recognises the urgency for action and the opportunities that are there in the financial transition. I hope that Spain and the UK can embrace these opportunities together at COP26 and beyond, for the good of our economies, for the good of our people, and for the good of the planet. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the invitation from the Official Monetary and Financial Institutions Forum and the Spanish Chamber of Commerce to speak on financial services and transitioning to net zero. This transition is a priority for all of us as we head down what I like to call the green brick road to COP26. The first climate conference where finance is recognised as a key theme. The IPCC report published last month underlined the urgency of the threat and the scale of the challenge from climate change. A challenge which requires us to harness the scale and expertise of the global financial industry. Because making the transition to net zero will require global investment of between $1 and $2 trillion every year. In other words, an amount similar to Spain's GDP. The report showed just how vital it is that at COP26, we don't just make progress, but this is a real turning point for the world. Sustainable finance is a crucial tool in the race to meet climate targets and reach net zero. A transition in which financial services will be absolutely vital. And a transition where the UK and Spain will lead the way. Fortunately, we have a strong partnership in financial services to build on. The Spanish presence here in the City of London and indeed on high streets across the UK is very strong. Spanish banks have the largest presence of all foreign banks in the UK, larger than Germany or the USA. Santander alone employs 20,000 people in the UK, the largest foreign bank in the city. Sabadell, the owner of TSB, employs a further 7,000 people. And I know that the Spanish government plans to launch its inaugural green bond this month, something we have also seen here in the UK. All those who work here in the City of London should be assured that we are backing up our words with actions. In 2007, the City of London Corporation became the first governing body in the UK to produce a dedicated climate change adaptation strategy. And last year, we launched our climate action strategy. To our knowledge, we are the first financial centre in the world to do this. This strategy will see us achieve net zero across the city by 2040. 10 years ahead of UK government goals. We also helped set up the Green Finance Institute to support sustainable finance solutions around the world. Because we know the financial solutions to climate change have to be global. So the City of London has been working to support the private finance agenda for COP, led by Mark Carney. I congratulate those Spanish banks, such as Santander, BBVA, the Caixa y Ibercaja, and Arm Bank, who have committed to the Net Zero Banking Initiative. We are now just over 6 weeks away from COP26, which must be a pivotal moment for our planet and a pivotal moment for finance. So to build on the Green Horizon Summit, which the City of London held last year, we have launched our plans for GHS at COP26. Our objectives are to mobilize private capital in the transition to net zero, and to provide as a platform for financial and professional services at COP26. Our agenda is designed to tackle four big questions. The first, how can we finance the transition? Second, how can we build a global playbook? Third, how can we price carbon and nature? And fourth, how can we meet and beat the $100 billion promise made at COP16? Now, to answer these questions, we are bringing together sustainable finance stakeholders across borders and across sectors, with content that is global, relevant, and challenging. This will be a 6-day hybrid event with a physical hub in Glasgow, linked to the City of London and financial centres around the world, reaching a global audience. I hope you will be able to join us at this event, and I hope you will work with us to make sure we keep the momentum going beyond COP26, sharing knowledge and expertise between financial institutions in the UK and Spain, and indeed around the world, will be vital to getting us through the climate crisis and meeting the challenge successfully. I wish you all a successful conference. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now we're very pleased to start the first session with Danai. So over to you, Danai.
Thank you very much, Lord Mayor, for setting the scene across UK and Spain, as you said, very big efforts in the financial sector. It's my pleasure now to welcome the first panel to talk about efforts in the UK and Spain. So welcoming to the stage Tony Balabriga, who is the head of global head of responsible business at BBVA. Welcome, Tony. Also have José María Roldán, chairman of the Spanish Banking Association. Very good to see you again. Ángel Martínez Alama, president of Inverco. Very good to see you. And we also have James Hutton, program director at the Green Finance Institute. Thank you very much for joining. Un placer to see you all again. I recall meeting in person last time, probably at the COP in Madrid, just before the pandemic hit. But let's start by talking about Spain and the UK and what we've seen so far. So maybe starting with you, Tony, to talk to us about Spain and what, in your view, have been some of the most impactful policies that we've seen since Spain hosted the last COP in terms of climate risk management in the financial sector and managing climate-related financial risks. And what do you think needs to be done more to accelerate this transition as we look ahead to Glasgow?
Well, congratulations for this session, and thank you for the invitation. Great pleasure to be here. I think that in Spain we have done a lot in the last years. I think we have already a quite robust policy framework to help us to align society and the economy as a whole to net zero. Obviously, we have some dependencies from Europe, but in Europe, European Union has set climate targets. We have from Europe also the newer strategy in sustainable finance, which is built on the action plan that was approved on the 2018 with great achievements. And also we have the Next Generation EU as a huge opportunity, you know, to mobilize finance to sustainability. So what is coming from Europe is very well aligned and also what we have at the national level is very, very relevant. No, we have approved our climate act. We have a just transition strategy. We have a national plan, energy and climate for 2030, and all them are aligned to net zero goals. No, so I think that in Spain we could say that in general we have the, as I said, a robust policy framework to net zero. No, but having said that, obviously we also see opportunities. No, to what's next. No, in my opinion, well, first I think that we need to work a little bit more on incentives for individuals and companies to promote behavioral change. Also to avoid dysfunctions, to avoid perverse signals like now that we have with energy price. Also in this sense, we need, secondly, to have right mechanism in the financial sector to incentivize financial flows and alignment to net zero. I have to confess that for the moment, when we see sustainable finance, all are cost for green finance. We need data, we need the standards, we need disclosure, we need supervision. It's a little bit overwhelming for banks. And market price differences between green and non-green are still low. So where is the carrot? No. So I think something we need to work on that. Third, I think we need support investment in key sectors and activities, working more on public partnerships in sectors difficult to abate. And finally, we will ask also a neutral policy, fiscal policy, and more coordination at the global level. Ambition and more certainty, especially on carbon price regulation. No, these are a few requests that we have on the table now. Thanks.
Thank you, Tony. A very complete list of what the financial sector needs. But as you said, progress is being made on a lot of these fronts, and we will be talking later also about the disclosures, the taxonomies, the data questions as well that you raised. And of course, we can go into also the EU's Fit for 55 plan and the kind of regulation that we're seeing coming through from the EU. But let me turn to you now, James, for the UK. And same question to you. What do you think are the most impactful policies that have been put in place? The UK has also put in place very ambitious targets. And at the Green Finance Institute, you work very closely with the finance community and the City of London. We heard from the Lord Mayor about the initiatives there and from Emma Howard-Boyd as well. But what do you think still needs to be done and what have been the most successful things we've seen so far? Thank you.
Thanks, Donna, and thank you very much for the introduction and the invite to today. I think keeping it probably brief, I think what needs to be done is there needs to be more of a collaborative conversation. I think too often policy is misaligned with the market risks that private finance are trying to tackle. I think there's a misalignment, there's a misunderstanding, and sometimes there's a mispricing of that risk. And so it's important that government and policymakers are in the room with private finance and with the entire supply chain making some of the decisions about how policy is implemented in the short term and the long term. I think the UK government absolutely have fantastic ambition. I think we're on our way to exceeding our third carbon budget then for the end of next year. I think there's risks though regarding, you know, budgets 4, 5 and 6. I think what we really need to see now is some collaborative policy moves will unlock what is, you know, clearly the private capital that's waiting in the wings.
Great. Thank you very much, James. And let me turn to you now, Jose Maria, with a similar question, but slightly different in terms of what are the biggest lessons that you think you have learned in Spain in terms of the actions to transition, to support the green transition and to manage climate-related financial risks. We heard from the Lord Mayor all the good things that Spanish banks have been doing. What do you think are the lessons that have been learned in terms of the practices that have been employed and what can be done differently going forward?
Yeah, well, the first thing I would highlight in terms of what is very relevant is that, you know, post-COVID, we have seen an international alignment on the fight against climate change that we have not seen before. So in COP25, we made, you know, a move forward, Spain and the Spanish banks. But it's extremely important that this was not an isolated movement by us, but you know that everybody was making the same progress at the same pace. I'm talking about the U-turn of U.S. policies in this respect with the new presidency, but also if you think about, you know, the post-Brexit world, the almost perfect alignment between the UK and the EU on this very important issue is of extreme importance. So I think that we should not underestimate the importance of this international alignment. I would also mention China. China being, you know, a big player is also showing, you know, the willingness to make progress in that respect. That is the first thing I would highlight. The second one is that, you know, for us, the fact that the EU recovery plan, the Next Generation EU, is offering us the possibility of building back better exactly on the areas where we saw the need to make progress. We're talking about green and we are talking about digital, and both of them are very closely united. Without technology, we will not be able to deliver what we need to deliver in terms of climate change. That has also been very important that at the European level, we have also this framework. And for Spain, you know, given the type of companies that we have, the challenge of helping SMEs is of the extreme relevance and of great importance. Spain is an SME-based country, and we have to think, especially the banks, because they are our clients, naturally they are our clients, we need to think how we can help them, you know, in making progress. And just to add some spice to my initial intervention so that not everything is rosy, I would mention that on the ideas that we are putting forward, I think that we need to abandon advocacy and inject greater certainty around the process. The fight against climate change has become mainstream. We don't need to work anymore on raising awareness. I think that anybody that has spent the summer in Spain with extreme events that we have just seen does not need to be convinced on the importance of the fight against climate change. This really has become mainstream, not just in terms of political parties, of financial institutions, also in terms of consumers, of citizens, of clients. So what I think that we are lacking is a little bit more of technical guidance and of planning going forward. If you allow me to use an expression I'm using, we need, you know, more plumbers of climate change and less apostles of climate change. So I think that we need to give this centrality. And why this is relevant? Yes, because we need capital and we need investment. But we know, we economists know, that without clear rules, without certainty, there will be no capital deployment and no investment deployment. So clear rules are a necessary, not sufficient, but a necessary conditions for capital and investments to take place, for capital to be available and for investment to take place. That would be my plea. We need to give a little bit more of certainty to the whole process.
Thank you, Jose Maria. Yes, very important that we are moving, as you said, from the why to the how. It's no longer about the motivations. This is clear for everyone. You mentioned the summer in Spain. I remember the winter in Spain as well. I spent winter in Spain. We had Filomena and all these very extreme weather events throughout Southern Europe. So, of course, something that's becoming very obvious. But as you said, also the combination of digital and sustainable as big items of the agenda and how they can reinforce each other going forward. And Angel, also your perspective on this in terms of what are some of the lessons that you've learned from your perspective in the rules that have been put in place for the green transition and what we still need to see in terms of incentives, both for avoiding damaging activities towards climate, but also supporting the green recovery and seeing that also as a growth story.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to thank the British Embassy in Madrid, the Spanish Chamber of Commerce in the United Kingdom, of course, ONFIP for organizing this seminar that, as you have mentioned, is in between COP25 and COP26. And a lot of things that has been done, my colleagues, have happened during this nearly 12 months. This is an opportunity that we have to, in front of us. We have not to lose the momentum because, of course, as has been said, there is a mentalization that this climate change has to be dealt, and the necessity for the financial sector, of course, banks, insurance companies and asset managers is crucial. There is an estimation from the European Commission that 300 billion a year should be invested, and clearly the public finances are under pressure, and they cannot cope and finance all this huge amount in order to transform our economy. So this is an opportunity that the financial institutions have to collaborate with the aims, of course, shared by not only politicians, but all the population. And there are some challenges ahead, of course. As been mentioned, clearly there has been movements in the US and China, but clearly there is not a huge commitment. But Europe has moved forward with clear calendars and with clear objectives. I think one of the COP26 objectives should be clearly to push on this region, China, US, and perhaps India, that nowadays with Europe are the more consumers in terms of pollution, and we have and should be necessarily to establish for them and that they should establish these clear calendars. And some proposals, of course, we need the rules are there, and we hope that should not be so complicated, should not change dramatically. We need clear rules, perhaps fewer ones, but more clear ones. And of course, financial education campaign is necessary. You have mentioned what happened in summer in Spain, but also we are seeing how the CO2 market is growing up prices. And clearly this have a should be paid or borne by the consumers. So our colleagues, our compatriots, and clearly if we don't explain what are the damage if we don't act, of course should not be understood that this we have to pay a price, but the price should be higher if we don't act. But clearly this transition process could have a price, a cost, and that should be important from the public organizations to share and to insist and clearly give a good objectives and good clear messages about the necessity to act and to spend huge amount of money with our of our budgets. And well, we perhaps we can have later on to comment on public and private collaboration, and there has been some examples in Spain that, and in Europe that we can continue speaking on.
Yes, thank you, Ángel. In fact, let's move on to that now, and perhaps let's start with you, Tony, on how do you see the right mix between public-private collaboration? What do you see the role of the state to be there? You mentioned before that you're not seeing enough carrots in terms of what the banks need to do, that the differentials between acting green and not acting green are not big enough to justify making all this effort. At the same time, a lot of banks are realizing that this is in their very own economic interest in terms of managing the climate risks, and the TCFD reporting is also beginning to become mainstream, even though it's still voluntary largely. But tell us a little bit about how do you see the balance there?
No, climate change is a new reality, especially for the financial sector, no? And it's something that is here. So as James commented, partnerships, collaboration is critical. I think that the things are changing. In the last years, recent years, we have seen a lot of collective work. We need to do more, no? But on financial regulation, for instance, we see regulators working closely with the private sector when defining standards or taxonomies. Also working closely with us in terms of disclosure, corporate disclosure. TCFD could be a good example, but also all related to corporate disclosure in general. But even in supervision, we see clearly, at least from the European authorities, a clear that we engage with them, obviously, often. We see a way to collaborate, to see how we can upfront this new reality. As Jose Maria says, we need more planning, more we need more guidance, but there is a very productive dialogue. So I think that on financial regulation, there is a partnership there or there is a collaboration that is becoming more critical. No? But also on finance mobilization, this is another area where we should work more. And also finally on data, no? To consider that data in certain cases is coming good that we could use. We could try to see how we can leverage on all the capabilities that we have and the public institutions that they have in order to manage better climate risk, especially, you know. So I think that's a good example where we have more partnerships. I think in Spain, we have very good experiences. I think a good partnership is, I probably Jose Maria would like to cover it, or maybe Angel, but FinRest, which is the Financial Center for Responsible Sustainable Finance here in Spain, is a great example of partnership. So I think that this is absolutely critical in this new era.
Thank you. And maybe just to follow up with you a little bit on that and on the kind of managing climate risk from banks, because, and you mentioned the data, and of course, you and I have had discussions about this as well, and we will be publishing a report on that as well. But the question is also on, some banks have raised the concern that if the real economy is not transitioning, as much as we want to do climate risk management and measuring, and following the disclosure recommendations of the TCFD, we are at the end of the day mirroring a diversified economy, which needs to transition itself in the real economy level. How do you see that, and how do you see the actions that banks can take when examining their portfolios and assessing transition plans of companies that they are lending to?
Well, this is very challenging because we need to have information from our clients to make the right assessment. So we are going to succeed unless our clients succeed in this net zero transition. We are here to help them on advisory, on financial solutions, but obviously data is absolutely critical. So it is very important to have the right sequencing between the regulation and disclosure and risk assessment in order to have everything on the right time, no? And that's the one of the main requests that we have. In our opinion, we think that there is room to collaborate more with the public authorities in general to see which kind of data we may have, we can share, and try not to reinvent sometimes the wheel, no? Because in terms of, for instance, energy efficiency, there is some initiatives in Spain. I know that the Green Finance Institute has been also working in UK on the topic. So I think this type of partnerships is the ones that we think that are more promising. No?
No, thank you. That's very important. And in fact, on the energy efficiency question, I'm also on the Advisory Council for the Energy Efficiency Mortgages Initiative in Europe, which has banks from across Europe participating in these pilot schemes. And the data is a big challenge that we're facing there, because in some countries you have the GDPR regulations, which means that the banks cannot really have access to the energy efficiency data because they're considered to be linked to individual data. It can become very complicated. And again, I think that's where the technology and the sustainability agendas need to come closer together. But let me turn over to you now, Jose Maria, and Tony already kind of gave you a hint to talk about the initiative that you have in Spain in terms of the Center for Sustainable and Responsible Investment, but also talk to us more broadly about how do you see the role of the public and private partnerships? How far do you think the state can go in terms of de-risking some of these investments or supporting green capital versus also managing the risk on the financial stability level?
Absolutely. I think that the public-private partnerships are essential if we are going to be successful in the fight against climate change. So it's not a question whether we need them. It's a question that how we do it. I would also mention, you know, the private sector partnership, FinRes, which Tony was referring to. It's the investment and firms and investment products, Angel, the banks and the insurance companies in Spain, you know, working together to raise, awareness. Also, to raise awareness not so much on the need to fight against climate change, on the things we need to do to be effective in the fight against climate change. I would say that what I perceive a little bit as problematic, if you allow me to say that way, is that banks and the financial system more broadly are going to be a key element in this strategy. Most probably, we are going to be the lead bird of the flock of fight against climate change. But banks and the financial system, and Tony was referring to that, and you were referring to that, being an important partner cannot be the sole lever, the only game in town. We need help, in particular from authorities, in terms of greater clarity on best practices, on data requirements, on supervisory expectation. And I think that, public authorities need to go a little bit outside the comfort zone. The comfort zone for them is we set the rules, you do as we told you. I think that this is complicated in this respect. We need to learn from each other. They need to listen to what we need to say in terms of the problems that we are finding and to be able also to change if what they are proposing does not make sense in terms of being effective. Here we have, kind of two risks. The risk of greenwashing. We all know it. It's self-evident. But on the other hand, we also have the risk of not having the right incentives in place. If we end up penalizing the good players, we destroy the incentive system, and without a good incentive system, we are not going to be able to be successful in terms of transition to a greener economy. So I would highlight the authorities, I would request the authorities that we need greater clarity to ensure that this is a fair process. It's not easy. Let's not fool ourselves. Because you have the starting point of each, player, in particular, banks or insurance company or investment firms. And you have, the progress they're making in terms of, where they start. You have to measure the starting point, and you have also to measure the speed, the progress that is being made. By far, it's not easy. But on the side of regulators, I think that we know what they don't like. We are not so sure what they like. And I think that in that respect, we need to work with them more closely so that really best practices emerge and we can apply all of us. Because if this does not happen, we are not going to be able to avoid the second risk that I was mentioning, that is wrong incentives being in place, good players being penalized. I think that is very dangerous for the whole process.
And how would you rate the communication between the banks and the regulators? Because you sit in the middle of that as well. You engage with both sides. Do you think it's something that has improved over time? I mean, because when you look at it for the economy as a whole, I think the financial sector does stand out as an area where regulators and the industry have very close communication ties. When you compare it, for example, to some sectors in the real economy, where I'm hearing from, I don't know, logistics companies who say we want to improve the regulation so that we can choose the green option, but we don't know who to talk to in government. We don't have those channels of communication in the same way. Whereas with banks, I think it's a lot more established in terms of regulation, because you've had that following the financial crisis as well. You have the kind of infrastructure to ensure that channels are very open.
Yeah, I would say that Ángel Estrada, who is my successor at the Bank of Spain in terms of position, is not a regulator. But I think that the regulators are better with the stick than with the carrots. We like sticks a lot. We have a problem with carrots. We find it difficult to find the adequate carrots. I would say that they realize that this is a very complex, regulators and supervisors, they realize this is a very complex area. I think that sometimes in public they are, very, very eager to tell the world that they don't like what they are seeing. And I think that they need to make the next step. Tell us what you like. Tell us what are the best practices. I'm thinking on the, EU stress test that was in place. It's very clear the message that we receive from relevant people, Frank Elderson, is that they don't like what they are seeing coming from the banks. But at the same time, they also recognize that our best practices, they are finding in each and every area. Well, the sooner we know about this, the better for all of us, because we will be able to apply the best practices. So I think that regulators, they need to work better with the carrots area. I think that the stick area is fine. They don't need to develop anything there.
Thank you, Jose Maria. I see Tony nodding there approvingly, but also you mentioned Ángel Estrada, and of course he's speaking on the next panel, and I can see he's logged on and listening to us right now, so I'm sure he'll have the chance to reply to you in the next panel in his intervention. But James, let's come back to the UK because we've heard about the initiatives in Spain in terms of public-private partnerships and also the engagement between the banks and the regulators. How does that look on your side? It was mentioned also the energy efficiency initiatives that you have. How have you seen that interaction in your experience?
I think the interaction is actually really improving. I think from our perspective, the public-private partnerships are totally key. I think in GFI speak, we call it coalitions. And I think in the UAP, that would be technical assistance, as we've talked about. I think, you know, we have coalitions around buildings, we have coalitions around nature, and one around road transport. And that's really bringing together public-private partnerships to unlock and, you know, work out what the barriers are to see if we can unlock that capital. I think for me, what we'd like to see more of, and I think the danger is there's actually plenty of money around. There's plenty of public funding. It's just where that public funding goes. And I think the problem sometimes can be, to send your Roldan's point about plumbers, that money goes to CapEx and it goes to very attractive headline making projects. And what we need actually is a bit of OpEx. We need people on the ground solving, you know, the problems. What's the actual detail that's going to overcome the barriers to investment in building renovation, the split incentives, the issues between landlords and tenants, and those sorts of things? We need to actually get people on the ground sorting that out. And so for us, you know, we're having really good conversations. The building coalition that we've got in the UK has 360 members, and we have a number of different demonstration projects we're rolling out at the moment. But we just need to continue to see that happening in the UK and in Europe, particularly at the moment in Europe, where the opportunity is now with the next gen funding over the next 5 years, making sure that the grant-based CapEx headline inducing projects are not prioritised over the long-term policy movers that will bring in the private capital that we've talked about today, which is needed to fill that gap. So, and I think if you look at the private finance hub strategy, if you look at the fact there's reporting and risk management there, and mobilisation, I think, is the fourth one. Mobilisation absolutely has to happen with public and private. We need, what are the shovel-ready projects that we can execute on? And the only way we're going to get that is through those partnerships.
Thank you. And we have a question from the audience, and maybe, James, you can take that, about following also from what Jose Maria was talking about incentives, in terms of what are the specific incentives that you think should be in place that we don't have at the moment? What would you see as a good incentive system, and how can the public sector set these incentives?
Quite topical. How about, so in the UK, when you buy a property, you pay stamp duty on that property. It's quite a stamp duty land tax. I think a great incentive in the building market would be to say, if you buy a property that is under a certain energy efficiency level and you then renovate it to a certain energy efficiency level, the stamp duty decreases. And it's not necessary to say it will decrease enough to pay for the full renovation, but it'll get home buyers thinking about, okay, I'm buying a property, I'm tying myself into this property, and therefore the energy liability that property represents. What do I need to do about that? Is there anything I can do? And that nudge can actually be revenue neutral to the Treasury, the way it's been designed, and something that we support, as well as I know mortgage lenders across the UK support. So it's triggers like that, more carrots rather than sticks, I think can absolutely work to, and also as a long-term incentive to, in one particular sector that I referenced there, the building sector.
Thank you. Great. Angel, over to you. And maybe you also want to suggest some of these more practical incentives, but I also wanted to ask you a little bit about what are the steps that can be taken to develop the COP26 private finance hub strategy, and what work you have done in that area.
Well, in fact, the role of the public and private partnership in terms that the COP26 should be aware. This is the FRAC, for example, is an example of how the industry is working together with the regulators. The European Financial Reporting Advisory Group now has been requested by the European Commission to deliver the first draft sustainability reporting standard by June 2022. So this is a way how we can work together. There are a lot of challenges ahead. One of them has been mentioned before, the cost of data. This is a very important issue, and how the information, not only for clients when we're speaking about banks, but in terms of issuers, when we're speaking about asset managers, the asset managers have a duty to inform in their reporting, in their reports, but they have not the data available. And if they should be the case, the cost of from the consultants is higher and higher. So this is now a way how the this single access point from the European Commission initiative could be an important milestone in order to overcome this problem. But unfortunately, the new directive or the new proposal, Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, should not be put in place until 2023. So in between, there is a gap that is could be misunderstood by the investors, because on one side you have not a clear rules, the 1, 2, even level 3 in terms of regulation, but at the same time you have some duties as asset manager or as a bank, but in my case, asset manager. So this is a way that during the debates in the COP26 could be dealt, and this is an appropriate calendar with clear objectives, with the taxonomy quite clear. We know that we are learning all together every day, so this is a lot of pressure over the regulators, over the supervisors, but at the same time over the private institutions, because the outcome should be, we have to deliver to our clients, to our compatriots, a clear rules, a clear information, and the way that this outcome should be produced depends on how the things should go in terms of clear sequencing, in terms of calendar. So I should like this plea that could be debated during the next COP, and hopefully the rest of the region should be at least half as European region has been in terms of establishing a clear calendar and a clear objective.
Great, thank you. And we have another interesting question from the audience about the taxonomy, because the EU has, of course, done a lot of work on its own, but the UK is now doing work on the taxonomy, and James, the Green Finance Institute, is very involved in that as well. But maybe, Tony, first from you, because you've been involved in the EU's taxonomy and you've been very closely working with that. What do you expect to be some similarities between the EU and the UK taxonomy? What have been some of the issues when in working with the EU taxonomy, you may have thought that perhaps the UK may take a different approach? Do you have any concerns about maybe some fragmentation there?
No, well, we hope a convergence, no, between taxonomies globally, not only in UK, but also in other regions and also in emerging countries. We are in favor to develop building blocks that can, well, each taxonomy should have the possibility to speak to each other, no, and to help assessment for banks and also for your capital markets investors. Otherwise, will be a great burden and great cost. This asymmetry will create, well, not the right certainty that we need, as Jose Maria said, no, about how to mobilize sustainable finance. So this is absolutely critical to have at least building blocks. We recognize that certain activities, we can be more or less ambitious in different parts of the world. That's normal. But we have to have this common building block. So in this sense, we really appreciate the work of the European Commission, at least to, well, putting this global, let's say, alignment as one of the four pillars of the new strategy in sustainable finance, this global ambition, no, to see how we can work together with the International Platform on Sustainable Finance in taxonomies, which is absolutely critical. No?
Thank you, Tony. And James, would be good to hear from you as well. Where do you see the kind of areas of convergence or potential divergence to be between the UK and EU taxonomies? And we're coming to an end. So after that, I will ask all of you a question about COP26 and what do you expect? So start getting ready for that. But James, over to you.
Well, I'll keep it brief, actually, tonight, because it's my boss is currently working through the taxonomy group. I think just very briefly, I think we feel that there's certain strengthening of ambition that can be carried out across the taxonomy. The last thing we want is a divergence. We've talked about collaboration. We don't want to diverge, but we're hoping that we can strengthen some pieces of the ambition of that taxonomy. And so that's really the plan at the moment. We're just getting into the weeds of that at the moment. So, but we certainly don't want to diverge.
Great, thank you. So COP26 coming up, 32 working days to go, I think. So what are your expectations and what are your hopes, very quickly? Angel, let's start with you.
Well, I've said before, hopefully it should be, as we have been saying, less words and more actions, clear commitments, and being knowing that everybody is learning every day. Please do the right appropriate things moving forward, but without turning around and turning back in terms of criteria, in terms of if nuclear should be in, should be out, the carbon, and so on, the brown activities. I think this is a question that clearly should be potentialized, because and to promote those companies, those sectors that are dirty ones, should be clearly incentivized to be more cleaner. So not just starting from scratch, not just only promoting new energies, but also promoting industries that are dirty and to, in order to be greener.
Thank you. Very important point. We shouldn't just growing the level, but reallocating within that. I think that's very important. Jose Maria.
Well, I think that, you know, I'm not a fan of government intervention, but I do think that the fight against climate change is a textbook example of the need of government interventions. Markets on their own will not fix the problem. So what we need, in the same vein as I was mentioning in my first intervention, we need clarity on who does what and when, not just on actions needed, but also on the timing of those actions, a roadmap, a clear idea of who does what, who is in charge. And if I may use a controversial quote, and I'm sure that this is going to be a controversial quote, I think that we need to apply the old slogan, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. I think that we need to be very clear on that. The second element I would like to mention is that we need to tackle the elephant in the room, how to deal with these specific sectors. And I'm not just thinking on coal, oil, or energy, but also chemical industry, cement industry, air carriers, sea carriers. Here we need even a clearer roadmap if we are going to succeed. And finally, we need international cooperation to continue. This is complicated. Without international cooperation, is mission impossible.
Thank you, Jose Maria. And yes, very important to also have in mind the inequalities that come with climate action and how that can make it politically unacceptable in some cases as well. We've seen that before, so it's important that action is accompanied by other corrective measures. Tony.
Yes, well, I agree with all has been mentioned. I would add two ideas. The first one is that obviously what is clear that we need ambition, as also pointed out by Gonzalo Muñoz. Well, according to the latest Carbon Action Tracker, we have 131 countries covering 73% of global greenhouse emissions that have adopted or considering net zero targets. But we need, as was said, more clarity about the NDCs from China or US, see the exact plans that they're going to have. And also see other countries that are very relevant, like India or Mexico. So we need really, really ambition, especially from certain emerging countries. But the second idea is that we not only need ambition, we need more multilateralism than ever. We cannot do it alone. We cannot do it without emerging countries. So our opinion is that article name, the famous 100 billion that only contribute now 80 billion in 2018 from developed countries to emerging countries, we need to have a robust framework to implement it, this 100 billion or even more. No? So we need a specific commitments by country on a yearly basis. We need clarity on how these commitments are going to be funded, specifying the role from private and public institutions, clarity on how funds are going to be allocated between nations, and obviously the right governance. No? So we think that this second point is absolutely critical. Otherwise, we are not going to get ambition from emerging countries without our support. So that's a key message. And finally, I think another idea is that private financial sector, I think that we have done the work. We have a lot in front of us, but thanks to GFANS, and in the case of the banks, we have the Net Zero Banking Alliance with 55 banks already. So we are already there to move from risk to opportunity. Thanks.
Thank you, Tony. And finally, James, the UK is hosting the COP, and you're of course very close to the organizers. What is your expectations and what are your hopes? Are they aligned?
I think they're certainly aligned. Yes, for this one time, I would say we haven't got much time left, but they are aligned, and I think they've pretty much been covered. I think you've talked about coal abatement, developing nations, the $40 trillion infrastructure gap that is there across the developing nations, and the, you know, as Antonio said, you know, it's definitely at least $100 billion a year, and we've missed the start date last year for that, so it's probably more. And you can see some, frankly, if I can say, anger from some developing nations that we're missing that. So those things are key. And I think then down to the more granular level, as Senator Roldan said, we need, what is the roadmap? We need, I think, for me, policymakers to be in the room with some of these coalitions, technical assistance, whatever you might call it. We need the private sector and the public sector to come together and actually have conversations at the same time. And not, you know, we need more carrots, basically. And so that, for me, would be what I'd like to see.
Great. Thank you very much, James. And thank you to everyone. Really great to have you all on the panel and have this conversation. We could be talking a lot more, but I look forward to hopefully seeing some of these suggestions that you've made here today become reality in not too long. It's now a pleasure to hand over to Eduardo Barrachina, who is the president of the Spanish Chamber of Commerce, to open the second panel. Over to you, Eduardo.
Thank you very much. Tonight, and good afternoon, good evening, everyone, from the City of London here, just 1 minute from the Bank of England. So I'm delighted to be here, and I thank OMFI from the British Embassy for organizing this extremely interesting panel discussion, and special greetings to Her Excellency, the British Ambassador, and a good friend of the Spanish Chamber of Commerce. It's very clear that the bilateral relationship between our both countries is probably at the best since probably Wellington came to Spain 200 years ago. United Kingdom is a key partner for us. It's been mentioned by the lords of the city, the contribution that the Spanish banks make to the British economy. And that relationship now under this new context can only improve. Unlike agriculture and the energy resources and the industrial sector, financial institutions contribute very little to global greenhouse gas emissions in terms of physical operations. And it's been very clear during the previous panelists and speakers that growing numbers of financial institutions are committing to delivering net zero finance emissions. And we know that they aim to achieve this through applying their capabilities and networks of relationships to support customers in their own transitions towards net zero. Many banks, pension funds, private equity, investors and insurers have already become carbon neutral in their day-to-day operations. So that's very good. And this has been achieved by improving the energy efficiency of the buildings and data centers, directly investing in renewable energy assets and procuring, more importantly, renewable energy credits and carbon offsets. However, I just want to share with you three or four reflections, and I'll be very interested whether someone in the next panel picks up some of them. We know the financial sector, and it's demonstrated today, plays a far-reaching role in funding the global energy transition away from fossil fuels by supplying capital and generating returns for traditional and low-carbon asset classes, while meeting at the same time, this is important, the broader needs of stakeholders, shareholders and investors. And I think this will pose a challenge and at the same opportunity, how financial institutions will balance this. This takes me to the second point, which is more practical, on whether financial institutions might be concerned about a potential escalating risk of default in the loan books, or poor performance in the investment portfolios. When we're talking about companies, borrowers who might be cut off by all these brave new wall and all this transition, do we know whether everyone will be able to not to miss the train? Whether I'm thinking of the sectors of transport, I'm thinking of industry, energy. It will be important just to ensure that no company is left behind, and that does not have a negative impact, as I said, on the loan books of financial institutions, or in a different way, that financial institutions are not put off by that risk. So I think that's a key aspect that I think we should all reflect about it. Another reflection is that, and I see this in my day-to-day work with other banks, financial institutions are still struggling with how to quantify and incorporate climate-specific risk in their investment underwritings, including how to balance their risk with meeting thresholds. This is something which is still being discussed, and I think it's worth listening to what other panelists have to say. We know very well banks' financing and investment sector is critical to deliver the sustainable infrastructure projects which are needed for this economic growth. And I'm particularly, you know, worried about the traditional transportation, educational and medical facilities, which are, you know, extremely expensive and at the same time carbon intensive. How banks will be able to finance all these huge, extremely huge and large projects will have to be addressed. I will finish with a very technical point as well, and this is probably me being a lawyer, but it's also important that we mention the role of derivative instruments when it comes to facilitate this transition to net zero. Derivatives are critical to channel capital towards sustainable investments. It really helps market participants to hedge risk related to environmental, social, and governance, the ESG factors. They facilitate transparency, price discovery, and market efficiency. And we know, because they've been few in the market, a number of derivatives which have incorporated key performance indicators as a way to articulate or calibrate arrangement systems that will encourage companies to meet actually those ESG objectives by giving them incentives in the premium or lower spread and so on. Don't want to go technical because it's not the place, but it's going to be one of those instruments which I think will be key. So from our perspective, and I finish, I reiterate that we at the Chamber of Commerce will remain extremely committed to this debate. Amongst our members and patrons, we have both British and Spanish companies which are working already in the preparation for COP26. Some of them are present here today, others are on the board. And as ever, we remain very open to help from London with in collaboration with the Spanish and British embassy and private sector and companies. So thank you very much to everyone, and thanks for the invitation.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFIF podcast.